Good evening. I'm Dr. Chelsea Bond and I'm a senior lecturer at the University of Queensland. This is our second conversation in the series, Contested Stories, and it is a book club conversation about Henry Reynolds' latest offering, The Forgotten War. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge that here tonight we meet, we gather on Aboriginal country. In acknowledging the Yuggera and Turrbal people of this region, I also want to acknowledge the lives that they've lost in their fight to maintain custodianship over their country. I want to acknowledge the warriors, the Brisbane warriors, Yilbung, Dundalee. I want to remember those people and remember the battle that continues in ensuring that their remains are in their rightful resting place. I would like to also acknowledge the lives that have been lost in war, black and white, on foreign shores and on these shores. I don't think there's anyone in this room that is untouched by war. It clearly is a topic that is dear to our hearts, and tonight as we speak from our hearts and speak from our history, we will speak with respect to each other and respect for those who have gone before us. So I'm going to hand over to the spectacular Dr. Sandra Phillips, who is chairing this conversation for us tonight. Sandra Phillips is a strong, proud Waka Waka woman. She is a lecturer at QUT's Creative Industries. She's had an amazing career in publishing, in policy, in academia, and I could think of no one better to facilitate this contested conversation tonight. So thank you for your stewardship. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dr. Bond, Chelsea. And I forgot I was going to do a little bit of a school mumish thing and ask the audience this evening who's actually read Professor Henry Reynolds' latest offering into Australian public discourse, Forgotten War, the principal reason we're here today. But I'll move to that little activity shortly. Let me first also acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather, without whose custodianship I believe we wouldn't be able to share, be as comfortable as we are tonight. So for their custodianship and also for their dispossession, I acknowledge their sacrifice and their work. So I acknowledge the Yuggera or the Yugara to the south of the Brisbane River and the Turrbal to the north of the Brisbane River. I am a Waka Waka and Gurang Gurang woman. I'm from countries in southeast Queensland, generally speaking. So now before we throw to one of our many guests of honour tonight, I will adapt my little activity from asking people to raise their hands if they've read the book to please saying, cooey. So when I ask, and then on the count of three, I want a cooey. And we'll just check out the sound and see what we think. So this evening, who amongst us has read Professor Henry Reynolds' book, Forgotten War? One, two, three. Okay. Maybe about 15, 20%. Yeah, okay. That just helps us because all of our panellists this evening are in part responding to Henry's contribution as well as contextualising their own priorities and practices over the years in relation to the way in which matters of history are viewed within Australia and within the globe, perhaps, in relation to Australian history. So without any further ado then, I'll ask Professor Henry Reynolds to take the lectern. The procedure for this evening will be Professor Henry Reynolds giving us a presentation of about 10 to 12 minutes. Each of our esteemed panellists after that, speaking for about 3 to 5 minutes. They're approaching the lectern or sitting down, depending on what they're most comfortable with. Then we will have a mediated conversation on the stage, and then we'll put all the lights up and it'll be your turn to ask questions and interact with the panel on the stage. So that's the format. We also might have a little surprise in between those sessions. So without any further ado, please welcome Professor Henry Reynolds to the stage.
Well, thank you very much for that welcome. It's very nice to be back in Queensland. It almost, though, seems as though we're back to the old bad Queensland that was here when we first arrived many, many years ago. But of course, I began this work particularly on frontier conflict many years ago too. I've been doing it for a long, long time. And there are those who are unkind enough to say, God, these old guys just go on repeating themselves. And to some extent, that is true. So why did I return to this subject in particular, and why now? Well, I returned to it in a way because I felt that I still had more to say following on from the history wars of about 10 years ago, which you remember were vigorous, often vicious, in which the whole project of trying to understand Aboriginal history was under a serious attack. And although I'd been involved in much of that debate, I felt there was still more to say about it. And also as a result of the history wars, a lot of new people did important research from all around Australia, and particularly in Queensland, re-examining and finding new materials about the conflict within Australia. So there was new scholarship, there were old arguments that I felt I still had to address, but there is the added factor of the way in which, in the last 10 years, we have come to make war the central national experience. That is, we've seen the militarisation of Australian history, funded with extraordinary lavishness by government. And this militarisation of Australian history is going to get even more intense over the next few years. So bringing those two things together is what really lies at the very, very heart of the book. That is, if as a nation we're going to say war is all important, it is war that made us, whatever do we do about the war within Australia? I begin the book with the thoughts of a young man in 1830 in Launceston, in Tasmania, talking and thinking about the Black War, as it was known then, and thinking at the end of that war, thinking about what it was that had happened. He started off by saying that a group of Aborigines who had been caught, they'd murdered prominent white settlers. He started off by saying, these people, we really have to string these people up. But as he thought about it, he came to realise that these were people who were fighting for their land. They were fighting for their country. They were heroes. They were warriors. And that they should be respected in the same way as societies, all societies, respect those who fight for their homelands. Now, the extraordinary thing is that those people who have read it, and hopefully more of you will, those people who have read it are struck by just how hard it is for us today to adopt those attitudes that were enunciated as long ago as 1830. So that raises the question of what do we do about this conflict? There's one more thing that I think has had an important influence on the way the book was shaped. Much of the work I've done over many years on this project has been, in a sense, looking at it from the bottom up. That is, you go and you find the accounts of conflict from all over Australia, probably even more particularly so in Queensland. You read everything you can, you find out where the conflict was, the people who were killed, the reason for the conflict, the weapons that were used. That is, you look at it from the bottom up. Now, in recent years, I've decided to look at it from the top down. What was the conflict actually about? The conflict quite clearly was about the ownership of Australia, the control of the landmass, and the sovereignty over a whole continent. That is, we're talking about the future and the destiny of one of the world's great landmasses. This is not minor conflict. This is one of the great conflicts of world history. I argue, and I believe very strongly, that this was Australia's Great War. This was far more important than the war in the Middle East and the war in Europe between 1914 and 1918, which really did little for Australia, achieved little for Australia, and had little to do with Australia itself, whereas the war around the frontiers, it lasted for so long, it was a war in Australia, it was a war about Australia. And that's why I would argue that this was not just minor conflict, this was a very important war. And above all, that being the case, I think we have to pay the respect due to those who fought in the endeavour to maintain control of their country, and many of whom died in the process, often facing impossible odds. These should be seen as heroes of our history and not heroes of wars fought elsewhere in the world. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Henry. And clearly you'll have plenty more opportunity to hear from Henry this evening. And we were just conferring earlier as to when the book was released. It was released around July 2013, so there's been a few months now for it to play within the Australian public discourse. We've got a few examples of the reviews that the book has generated, which will help inform our conversation in the next stage of this evening. And this evening, though, instead of having the two-dimensional perspective I was thinking two-dimensional, the actual paperwork, as opposed to the conceptual contribution, but we've got the three-dimensional contribution from the stage, from illustrious Australians who have read the book and who wish to contextualise their understanding and appreciation of the work. So, of course, the next wonderful speaker we have tonight is Professor Fiona Foley. And Fiona's going to share with us some insight and perspective to her own artistic practice, which, of course, is world-renowned. So could we please welcome Professor Fiona Foley.
Oh, this is so scary. I'm from the Wundunna clan, the Butchler Nation. Our country is all of Fraser Island and the mainland. To the north, the mouth of the Burram River, to the west, Bopple Mountain, and to the south, Double Island Point, Tincam Bay. I love reading this book, and I've got 11 images that I'm going to show in conjunction with what I'm talking about this evening. The book covers a lot of terrain and poses some great questions, and for those of you who work in academia or primary schools or high schools, one of the first sort of questions that leads us in is, should children be taught history that made them proud of their country and be shielded from history that was unduly critical of the founders and pioneers? That's something to really ponder, because that's been put out in the mainstream by well-known politicians. The book goes on to draw out a range of ideological arguments, and the quote I'm using is that a state of war did not exist in Australia. Terms like guerrilla warfare and genocide and their origins are discussed. The practice of dispersing Aboriginal camps with Snyder rifles, Winchesters, Martini Henry repeating rifles and Colt revolvers. And still the lingering question of whether genocide had occurred in Australia. Facts keep cutting through a wall of silence. In Chapter 2 we learn, frontier conflict, one of the most persistent features of Australian life for 140 years. First image, please. Around page 80, the war shifts gear, and this was very interesting for me to understand that there was actually a shift in the way the war was fought. From the clumsy redcoats in Sydney and the Tasmanian Black Line to the middle of the 19th century, frontiersmen, many of them now native-born and have become skilled bushmen, through the accumulation of knowledge and skills from Aboriginal people. The introduction of horses, repeating rifles, and the native police are now in common use. So in Queensland, the native police started here in 1848 and existed throughout the state for 62 years. Next image, please. Chapter 6 highlights the juxtaposition between the Sudan War and the Frontier War taking place in Queensland. The Australian War Memorial, Canberra, opened in 1941. Within its halls of memory are six Australians who lost their lives in the Sudan campaign, 1885, not from gunshot wounds, but from disease such as dysentery. The irony is that in Australia, at exactly the same point in time, a very real war was being waged in the northern third of the continent. In northern Queensland, 13 settlers were killed. There is no acknowledgement in the Australian War Memorial of the destruction of Aboriginal society, Aboriginal lives, or the deaths of white settlers in 1885. Next image, please. In Forgotten War, we are reminded of the fear and trauma existing in the very everyday lives of the settlers. Settlers' fears were heightened by their own fantasies. Next image, please. On the one hand, we have imagined fears by the settler men and women of the black race. On the other, we have inhumane violence being carried out day after day against Aboriginal clans. Next image, please. I cannot imagine the trauma experienced by Aboriginal men, women and children living during these times and seeing extraordinary terrorism, the burning of bodies, shootings, bashings, rape and kidnappings. I really like the statement when it says, "And the dead do need to be remembered," on page 134. We see this in your cultural practices with 4,000 to 5,000 war memorials of Australians' fallen soldiers in overseas battles. But in Forgotten War, there is no equivalent or public memorial for frontier wars fought. Two monuments to the frontier wars do exist, but are rarely discussed in terms of this debate. I would like to take this opportunity to remind the audience that there are memorials created by Aboriginal conceptual artists dotted around the country, and they don't receive much attention when it comes to the frontier wars. So what I wanted to do was highlight John Mundine, who's here tonight in the audience, so you can make a connection with him by this image. Next image, please. He created this piece, which is on permanent display at the Australian National Gallery. It was first created in 1988. It's called the Aboriginal Memorial. A part of the condition for the Australian National Gallery to purchase this work that it had to be on permanent display. So when it was first installed, it looked like this. It's acknowledging the Aboriginal people who died nationally defending their land. Next image, please. So this is the new installation with the new wing that's been added to the Australian National Gallery. So when you go, you will first enter the building through the downstairs area and go up an escalator, but you will pass this, principally made by artists from Ramingginning community, but also neighbouring communities. The other acknowledgement I'd like to make is the second sculpture called Witnessing to Silence. Next image, please. And this is outside Brisbane's Magistrates Court. This is a work of mine that I had to be very subversive about and not reveal to a soul what the true meaning of the work was. I had a researcher work on the project and I asked her to find for me all of the massacre sites that she could in the state of Queensland. Next image, please. She came up with 94. Since that time, there would be, you know, new engravings in the pavement. Next image, please. So you can see the two vertical elements. It's symbolising on one side here in this image, ash, and on the other side is a misting device. And why the symbolism of water and fire is because that's how they would get rid of the evidence, through burning the bodies or dumping them in watercourses. So on the right, you can see some of the names that have been identified on the public record. What does get discussed in Forgotten War is the avoidance and denial in the visual landscape at Reconciliation Place and the Australian War Memorial pertaining to Aboriginal deaths from the frontier wars. Frontier communities were notorious for keeping secrets of their exploits in the war. And so it would seem so also in modern Australian society that we want to keep a lid on this, we want to keep the silence continuing. How do you move forward and create new symbols? And this is something I really want you to think about. Maybe it's not a matter of piggybacking on the Australian War Memorial, but creating an entirely new institution. And it could be something like this, a National Aboriginal Holocaust Memorial Museum. I know that's a mouthful, but I want you to take that in. We could build a totally new institution that acknowledges these frontier wars, like the one that's the Jewish Museum in Berlin. Next image, please. So in conclusion, the sentence that sums it up and what Australians need to remember is there is no account for how the Crown acquired that sovereignty and when it occurred. Thank you.
Fiona is obviously a great advertisement for fear. So, she did a fantastic job there, obviously. So thank you so much, Fiona. And you've given us a really curly one at the end, so we'll return to that in conversation. The use of the H word in Australian history is very uncommon, but it's worth having some kind of dialogue around that this evening. So our next speaker this evening is Dr. Anthony Dillon, who has been invited to contribute to the discourse. We have a diverse panel, and in fact we haven't screened each other before and we don't know what each other's going to say. So Anthony, I hope you also get to surprise us a little.
Thank you very much. Great to be here back in Queensland, which is my home. I'm living in Sydney, but it's great to be back here where I belong, I think. The lights are on earlier, so I want to say that we can't see you now, but I could see you earlier on, and what a beautiful audience you are, so it's great to be talking. Save that praise towards the end, because I'll have a weak ending, and that's when I'll need the praise, I think. But I sincerely mean that it's a beautiful audience, and it's great to be talking to you. I read Henry's book and loved it, couldn't put it down. It's a book I have been recommending, and I highly recommend it to others. And one of the things which, some may see this as a minor point, but something that I liked straight away, he used the term Aborigine, the noun, instead of Aboriginal and Aboriginal person. And why I admired that, because I've had many people over the years say, oh, the word Aborigine is inappropriate, it's offensive, etc., etc. It's not. It's correct grammar. It's the appropriate word to use. And Henry used it, so he won me over from the start. I started on a high and finished on a high. There was there were no sort of lulls. It was good reading all the way through. It's a story that needs to be told, and I'm all for truth coming forward, and Henry's done a great job. It's a book I would like to see in all universities, all schools. I would like to see memorials. I would like to see our original warriors, our ancestors. I would like to see them honoured and remembered. I have one concern, and this is the bit where I've asked you to save your praise. And I know from discussions in the past people don't like this, but as much as I am all for this being recognised and brought to the front and acknowledged and that sort of thing, my concern is it may not happen, although I hope it does, but it may not happen. An official acknowledgement may not happen. We may not see all the memorials we wish to see. And let me tell you, I'd be the first one signing a petition saying we need to see memorials, but it may not happen. And if it doesn't happen, I don't think it's wise for people to say, until it does happen, we cannot move forward, we cannot be happy, we cannot be successful, or whatever. So I just want to stress that success, peace and happiness should not be contingent upon a recognition at the national level within this country. I hope it does happen, but I'm just saying it should not be an excuse for the continued success of Aboriginal people in this country. And in this country, we all know we have superstars. We have 30,000 university graduates, Aboriginal university graduates. We have doctors, lawyers, teachers, carpenters, the whole range of successful people. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Anthony. That's fantastic. You did throw us a nice little curly one. While Helen gets comfortable, what I'd like to perhaps talk a little bit more about later is whether remembering the dead, as Fiona and Henry referred to, is a prerequisite for a nation and peoples within it to reconcile and resolve the past so that they can move forward in a more positive and proactive and, to use your word, successful way. So that's the particular pivot that I think we might have a little bit of conversation about later. So now our fourth panellist for this evening is Mrs. Helen Carrick. Helen was awarded her first degree the year before I was born. In, I believe, from memory, history and anthropology from the University of Sydney, and has spent many years, subsequent years, pursuing her interest in the making of history, as well as a whole range of other things. So please welcome Helen, Mrs. Helen Carrick.
Thank you. Thank you, and it's a real honour for me to be here, and especially with Professor Henry Reynolds. Reading his book, Why Weren't We Told, was one of the sort of major changes in my life. I'm not here to pull this book apart or anything because I think it's sensational. But my big interest is that this, the fact that Australians still don't know their Indigenous history, and trying to get that out to a broader community is what I've been trying to do over the last decade and more. Some of the particular things in here, though, that I thought were absolutely wonderful were the explanation of the serenity and that the early settlers were actually not following what was the traditional international law in the way they were claiming the land. I just sort of found that, you know, a fact that I'd never sort of thought about before. I was also really intrigued about, why is the Australian War Memorial so powerful? You know, who are its governors? You know, it has been suggested that the Indigenous wars were included for so many years, originally by Blaney, would you believe? And, you know, I just think, well, why do they keep knocking it back? And they keep saying, oh, it's not in the whatever the words are. But just last year, I signed a petition on change.org because somebody wanted peacekeepers' names to be put on the wall. And they changed it. So it can be changed if people want to change. So I think, you know, if people made more of an effort to actually sort of agitate a bit, maybe we could start a petition on change. I don't know. But, you know, it's just such a powerful history that just needs to be taught in schools. And even that now we have our... is the new national curriculum going to be under review? You know, it's just been for people like me who've been involved for so many years, when we finally saw that it was getting into the Indigenous perspectives and Indigenous history was getting in, you know, is that under threat again? So I just think there are so many sort of issues. And one of the other things that I very much liked was that it's like a lot of the white people in power were sort of saying to the colonial office what was going on. And in 1837, there was a House of Commons Select Committee, and they said that it might be presumed that the native inhabitants of any land have an incontrovertible right, to their own soil, a plain and sacred right, however, which seems not to have been understood. Europeans have entered their borders uninvited, and when there, have not acted as if they were undoubted lords of the soil, but have punished the natives as aggressors if they have evinced a disposition to live in their own country. And so that was 1837 to the House of Commons in England. So, you know, there has been this sort of controversy. I didn't really want to know, was it a war? A lot of people said it's not a war. You know, what does that word mean? If you lose your land, you lose your culture, to me that's, you know, that's what war leads to. Yeah. Okay. So, keep going?
If you wish to, absolutely, absolutely. If you've got a few more minutes, then maybe mention the one of the ways that you...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So one of my big efforts over the last decade has been setting up a group called Reading for Reconciliation, and it's great to see so many of you here tonight. Thank you for coming. And our group is trying to learn some history, and this actually, Henry, is on our agenda for our last meeting of this year. Before I even knew about this, this was one of the books we had to read. So in schools, I think, you know, things have improved, but there are still so many sort of middle-aged, dare I say it, white Aussies out there who still don't know their history. This is probably a converted audience here, but there are some really sensational books and things that you can read and get involved in, and our group is just sort of one of them. That's a little bit about us. We got into the finals of the Queensland Reconciliation Awards in 2012, and this August we turned 10. And so that means we would have read, almost 70 books over the years. So if anybody wants more information later, please come and talk to me over a glass of wine. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Helen. Wonderful. Thanks very much. Now, I believe we're changing the lighting to the next level, correct? Let me turn up the house a little so that as we converse, we can see you a little. That would be great, before we throw to the Q&A. Okay, so I think we've had fantastic contributions, quite diverse contributions from the panellists this evening. I've already pulled out a few of the maybe trickier bits that we could have a bit more of a chat about now. From, on the one hand, the idea to remember the dead and fallen who fought defending their lands on this continent, remembering effectively and either through some, ensuring the Australian War Memorial has exhibitions or has formal recognitions, or in Fiona's provocative mention the idea of a completely separate institution. If I recall correctly, the working title, National Aboriginal Holocaust Museum.
Yeah, Aboriginal first. Aboriginal. I've got to look it up myself.
It's so new, this idea. It's fantastic.
I don't have a National Aboriginal Holocaust Memorial Museum.
Memorial Museum.
So threw everything in there.
Yeah, so could we have a bit of a conversation around that? So have you come to that position after years of the historical research you've put in to develop your installations and other symbolic forms that you've put into the public space?
No, I just think it's a type of discussion that we've had previously under previous prime ministers where they don't want to acknowledge a state of war existed here in Australia. And therefore, the Australian War Memorial is not going to allow anything in of that nature into that particular institution. So basically, you're hitting your head up against a brick wall. How do you get around that? How do you navigate around that? So you have to be strategic. So do we totally set up a new institution and go around them that way? Because this history is so important to be told and taught that we do need something of national significance, and I'm sure a lot of international visitors coming to these shores would like to access that information and go to some sort of institution like that. So when I go to Germany later this year in May, I'm definitely going to have a look at the Jewish Museum in Berlin. And there's a particular installation there called Falling Leaves, which has 10,000 faces made out of metal. The discs are only about that big, and it's in a void, and you have to walk across this floor of these metal faces. And the sound that it makes is just unbelievably haunting, because you're remembering these fallen Jewish people. Mm. And I think we need something like that here. We need big, bold statements in a beautifully designed architectural building by a Torres Strait Islander or an Aboriginal architect.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Fantastic.
Thanks.
Indeed, I had a German student, an international student, who was doing a first-year introductory compulsory Indigenous Studies unit at university level who was just gobsmacked that her fellow students who were Australians had little to no idea of the history on this continent. And she contributed in tutorials that in Germany we have to engage with this over and over and over because it gets a bit boring, she said, but it is essential for us as a nation to deal with and grapple with this so that we, you know, can be better than that. We can continue to be better than that. Henry, can I throw to you and ask you what you think of that idea?
I think there's a lot to be said for it. I think one of the questions I raise in the book is the question of, are we one nation or more than one? You know, are we two nations or even three nations? That is, you know, we're in one state. You know, one state, in that sense, a nation state. But is there more than one nation? Now, conservative Australians will overwhelmingly say, no, we are one people, we are one nation, we are one. You know, this is absolutely central to their rhetoric. Well, if that is true, you know, you simply have to allow the Aboriginal people to have their dead recognised in the pantheon, as Brendan Nelson said, it is the soul of the nation. That's what they say about the Woolmer. It's the soul of the nation. And clearly, many people believe that. Mm. And they go there with reverence. You know, I spent quite a lot of time in the Woolmer in recent times, and I find it a fascinating place, but it has got that reverence, and it's the most visited place. And all Australian children are expected to go there. And if you get money to go to Canberra, you've got to go to the War Memorial. You know, you're told. And if you don't go to the War Memorial, well, you don't get any money. And my daughter, who was trying to organise a primary school trip, she said, well, I don't know that I want my children to go to the War Memorial. Why do they have to go there? And the thing was, well, because that's where you learn what it means to be Australian. So they've made this so central to us.
Yes.
Now, if that's the case, well, you've got to put the fallen Aborigines in there. Now, if that isn't possible, and Brendan Nelson has said no, it certainly won't be in his time, well, there's a separate institution, and the War Memorial should be told they could lose a third of their funding, which is lavish. It is perhaps one of the few institutions that doesn't get money cut back. It gets more, almost what they ask for, they are given. They'll be given more and more and more. Well, all right, if you can't deal with the war in Australia, then you have to give up some of your funding for a separate institution.
We have a highly learned and very confident panel tonight, haven't we? It's fantastic. Fantastic. And Henry, I like in your work where you refer to the recognition of the psychological ramifications of being descended and being of an invaded people. Mm. You highlight that the wars that are commemorated in Australia, memorialised, are those wars that have been fought on other people's land.
That's right.
And fought as invaders rather than the invaded. So can you just kind of tell us a little more on that?
Yes, I think there isn't the empathy, there isn't the compassion, there isn't the understanding and the respect that has to be there.
Yeah.
And this is particularly so where, now of course the suffering of men and women, but overwhelmingly men overseas who suffered and died and were prisoners of war, no one is, if one moment, is saying we should diminish that. But for God's sake, I mean, one thing, they all got injured or died far away from Australia, usually in situations where they at least had the weapons equal to or superior to the people they were fighting. They also knew that their families were completely safe back in Australia. Mm. Now, this is so different to the experience, Aboriginal experience. And the other thing about the Aboriginal experience, I think, is that we should have that terrible sense of loss. You know, we celebrate what has survived. But just think of the languages, the dances, the stories, the designs, the whole cultural richness that was just lost. And that is tragic in the very precise meaning of the word tragic. So I just think we have to see it as a war of really much greater importance. And then there's the question of what happens after the war. Now, after the war, so many Aboriginal people were forced onto what essentially were prisons. They weren't allowed to leave, and this went right up until the 1960s, It was only in the 1960s people were allowed to leave places like Palm Island. They were there permanently, their children were there permanently, and one has to look, if you look at it in this way, they have to be seen as prison camps. Mm-hmm. And they have to be seen the same sort of camps that were used in other parts of the world, to our horror, the places where people were sent for re-education. Because that is what they were trying to do. So in all sorts of ways, you know, we have to see the magnitude of it, and which we don't.
Wonderful, thank you. And I'll throw to you on that point too, Anthony, because you work in an area that has the concepts positive psychology, the concept positive psychology in its workplace title. What do you think is beneficial in ensuring memorialisation of wars that happened on this continent?
Oh, well, all I can say is I agree with what was just said then by Henry. But like I said, it may not happen. If it doesn't happen, we have to ask the question, what should we do? And I think we should not let it be a reason for not continuing on the good path many Aboriginal people are on. So again, I just emphasise, yes, I would like to see... If I was to retitle the book, I would probably call it The Most Important War. That's a title for your sequel. So, yeah, it may not happen. And if it doesn't happen, let's not make it an excuse for not continuing on the great things that have already been done. Because, Aboriginal people have shown... what a powerful, resilient people they are.
Which makes me think two things, and I'll throw to you soon, Helen, but to whether our society can sustain two narratives, one that recognises the past and that also helps lay the fertile ground for moving forward as well. So whether it's an either-or narrative or whether we can actually be mature enough to do both at the same time. Helen, can I ask you on that? What effect has learning about a history that isn't particularly celebrated, what effect has that had on your life?
Well, my life actually got changed dramatically about 35 years ago, I think it is now, and I heard a woman from Cherbourg speak. It was actually at a Brisbane Carthaginian Service Day, and their new centre at Inala had just been opened, and this wonderful lady was coming to speak to the teacher librarians. And I just could not believe her story. And I just thought, hey, you know, I majored in history. Why on earth don't I know anything about that? I'm a pretty well-read person, I think. And honestly, and then I read Henry's book, and I read Sally Morgan's My Place, and the sort of three things sort of, you know, really impinged upon me. So I've been trying to learn as much as I can in my own life, and also trying to find ways, you know, to get this knowledge out to others. And I'd like to suggest something that's been a dream of mine for many years. My dear husband Frank up there and I are turning into grey nomads, and we love going to all the little museums in all the whatever country town we go to. And there's all of Great Granny's beautiful porcelain from Ireland. And there's this room after room. And if you're really lucky, there might be one grinding stone over there in the corner. Mm. Some new places now are actually acknowledging the traditional owners and have better displays. But they're all the positive thing. Now, these are the fantastic fishnets. If you've ever been to Rawarana and seen the fish traps, fantastic. But none of them talk about the first conflicts. So I would like to step back quite a bit, not to a big national museum, but to come back to all the little museums throughout the land and have them acknowledge the lifestyle of the traditional people before and what happened to those people. The conflict then, you know, in that particular place. And I don't know how that would happen in Brisbane, but when she mentioned Dundalee before, and I mean, I only found out about him a few years ago, and I thought, now why aren't Brisbane kids being taught about these things? You know, hands up if you've heard of Dundalee in the audience. Yeah, a few. You know, and there's just so much that still is not being taught. And I think if we could get it back to a local level, then it would really change, you know, the whole sort of scheme of things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think, as well as things at the centre, I think the idea would be that now that there are Aboriginal organisations practically all over the country, partly following on from land rights, that there are, you know, there are organisations everywhere. Mm. And I think the call should go out that it is now possible to receive funding for a local, some sort of local monument. Now, there are monuments to all the wars in every little village, you know. Now, I see no reason why the offer shouldn't be made for people to do something in their own country. Mm. Now, they may say no, they may say, yes, we'd like to do this, but just think of the incredible variety of things that you would probably get that would deal with the situation in that place.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that is the second part of it, apart from what we might do in Canberra, for instance.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And just reflecting on that too, I can't remember the actual stats. Someone in the audience might know it. The appallingly low levels of trust that the Australian Social Barometer of 2010 reported exists between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australia. From memory, it's a single digit, 4 or 9%.
Yeah.
So this perhaps we could imagine, without too much hard work, that the unreconciled history has led to this chasm in relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australia. Do you think that's contentious to imagine that as the case, Pamela? Is it contentious to think that the lack of historical reconciliation of our histories has led to contemporary chasms of relationship?
Can I just mention another Brewarrina issue? At Brewarrina, like a lot of the grey nomads have, you know, these walkie-talkie things that they talk to each other. And we overheard a lot of people saying, oh, don't go there, excuse the language, but there's a whole lot of abos under the tree. You know, like they were warning the other people not to go to that particular place. And I just thought, you know, and Brewarrina has this absolutely amazing World Heritage listed site there. You know, and they obviously didn't know or care about that. They were just, and I think they're frightened. And that's why, like in my own story, I've been blessed that I have met so many wonderful Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and count them among my friends. But most white Australians still do not know an Aboriginal person. So this fear, you know, I really do think there's this sort of fear of the unknown. Mm. And I think, you know, our group is called Reading for Reconciliation, because when I started it, I was also inspired by Professor Harry Messel's words of why is it so? And a lot of people sort of say, kids are sniffing and all this sort of stuff. And I'm hoping that, you know, people will, if they learn the history, know some history, they'll make them much more understanding of the present sort of situations.
You spend quite a bit of time working off that theme too, Henry, of the anxiety that was in the minds of settlers on the frontier for decades throughout the centuries. How do you think that plays in contemporary times?
I think there is. I think Helen's right. I think there is that distance and that uncertainty. They don't know what they should do or say, and indeed there is that worry. And I mean, you know, Margaret and I spent 34 years in Townsville. We are seasoned Queenslanders, and I mean this used, you know, certainly more in the past than now, but you used to see that sort of thing every day, if you lived anywhere near the city as we did. So, you know, in a way, my work comes out of that very experience.
Yes.
That you saw it daily, you know, and it wasn't just the, you know, the fighting, and wasn't always white bashing black, blacks bashed whites, you know, you saw the conflict as an everyday thing. But it was also the uneasiness, the difficulty of social relations that was what stunned us when we arrived in the place. So,
guilt.
Well, I'm sure, yes.
Mm.
So just to change the tack a little bit, and then the audience member who contributed something there, you might frame a question when we move to the Q&A, but I liked your chapter, What Was at Stake, and you really get into the nitty-gritty of the international context of history in Australia. So, you know, it's something that we're concerned with as people who exist in this nation state, but give us a little bit of an insight to where you think we sit in an international context. You write about it.
Yeah. Well, the international law and practice at the time Australia was settled was that the indigenous people, indeed, the local people, owned the land on which they were, and they didn't have to be agriculturalists, they could be hunters, they were in occupation of the land. And they also had a form of sovereignty. That was recognised. So in America, you had the continuation of the idea that the Indians continued to have a form of sovereignty, and they are still called domestic dependent nations. You needed to make treaties with them, and that was so right across North America, right across Canada. I mean, the vast contrast between very comparable places, the same sort of settlers at exactly the same time, is the settlement of Queensland, central North Queensland, with the settlement of the Canadian prairies. Mm-hmm. In Canada, there was almost no violence. I mean, there was a rebellion of the Métis, but that's a different story. There was almost no violence because it was all done by treaties. They're called the numbered treaties, and they were signed right across the prairies. And, of course, the Canadians are now negotiating new treaties in British Columbia, which hadn't had them. But there was that recognition, just as there was in New Zealand. You began settlement in New Zealand with the Treaty of Waitangi. Now, as we know, for many years it was neglected, but now it's the central constitutional document. So there was that recognition. Now, when the British came to Australia, they neither recognised the property nor the sovereignty. There was nothing there. So it was easy to say the conflict was about little things, like stealing or savage people, because supposedly there was nothing there. You know, the British gained both in one, you know, as soon as they arrived, which is just ridiculous. Now, the Mabo judgment, as we know, said, yes, well, of course these people owned the property, and they lost it, but some of them still have property rights. So that was the fundamental change. Now, if that is the case, they must also have had sovereignty. But the Australian courts say, well, we can't deal with this because we are the product of that claim of sovereignty and we can't go behind that. Now, that I think the High Court is copping out of that fundamental problem. Were the Aboriginal people nation sovereign? And I'm sure they were. By the international law of the period, were they sovereign? Yes. How do they lose the sovereignty? And if they are those people still living on their country, do they still have some sort of sovereignty? Is there remnant sovereignty? Now, those questions simply are never been dealt with. Mm-hmm. And that's what intrigues me about constitutional recognition. What is it going to recognise? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is it going to say, yes, you were here before we were? Well, we know that. But is it going to recognise this prior sovereignty? Mm-hmm. Which then raises the question, how did the British acquire it? Mm-hmm. There's only two ways, by treaty or by conflict. Mm-hmm. You know, by invasion, by annexation. And they are issues we've still got to deal with. And if the High Court in Australia won't deal with it, I think we've got to try and get an opinion from the International Court of Justice. Mm-hmm. Not a judgment, just an opinion would be a start. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because there's got to be some judicial explanation of what happened, mm-hmm. how and when it occurred. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. And clearly the questions aren't going to go away.
No.
Indeed, they'll probably proliferate the more that we don't address them. So can I thank the panel this evening for our conversation here?
Thank you. Thank you.